Colleges and universities in the U.S. are sometimes called ivory towers, self-contained communities with high-minded ideals. But they're still run by people.
Incentive structures inside of higher ed lead to situations where people can promote their interest at the expense of everybody else.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a pair of researchers who say there are growing cracks in higher ed's ivory tower. We'll also spend an academic minute looking for parity in the potty. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Merriam-Webster defines ivory tower as a secluded place that affords the means of treating practical issues with an impractical, often escapist attitude, especially a place of learning. Universities aim to be centers of learning that find the best and brightest students, treat them fairly, and equip them with the knowledge they need to lead better lives. But the message of the new book, Cracks in the Ivory Tower, The Moral Mess of Higher Education, is that American colleges and universities fall far short of that ideal. We're going to talk about that today with the authors of that book. Dr. Jason Brennan is the Flanagan Family Professor at Georgetown University's School of Business. And Dr. Philip Magnus is a Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. I started off by asking Dr. Brennan how this project got started.
The funny thing about it was we didn't originally plan to do this project, but a few years ago, there was a sort of movement of what you might call the adjuncts right movement all around the country, where various kinds of people who have these somewhat precarious part-time positions working for universities where they're paid a small amount to teach a class were arguing that they deserved a lot more money. And so we wanted to know, is it actually possible to do that? And what we did was look at all the various demands that activists had put out, that various lobbyist groups had put out, or that different unions had defended, and just simply got data from the Department of Education and said, how much would it cost to actually fulfill these demands? And it turned out that the low estimate was something like about $15 billion. The high estimate, depending on which demands we were looking at, was about $60 billion, which represented a 15 to 60% increase in the total costs of that we're paying towards professors. We realized that this is a case where people's moral language was in a sense not in tune with the economics of the situation. And that really turned into this bigger book where we started looking at the pathologies of higher ed as a whole.
One thing you see in the higher ed literature is a lot of claims that are made almost from a perspective of opinion, but there's very little data that's ever brought to bear to test some of those claims. So people have strong opinions about what's wrong with higher ed, and we started looking into some of the records and the statistics that are coming out of the Department of Education, and it doesn't quite align with the standard narratives that you encounter.
And actually, adjuncts will not be happy with the conclusion you come up with, I'm pretty sure.
No, we find that if in most cases it's prohibitively expensive to deliver the demands that they have. And one other problem is that some of the demands they're making, even if we did fulfill them, it would involve firing approximately two-thirds of adjuncts in order to give much better positions and more pay to the other third.
Well, this book took a much larger scope than just the adjunct argument. When did you say you're just going to attack the entire university college system?
Well, there's nothing quite so delicious as the hand that feeds, so that's where it came from. It really came out, an editor contacted us and said, you know, what if you wrote an entire book on adjuncting? And we said, well, that's kind of boring. We don't want to spend all of our time on that. But it would be good to have a book that looked systematically at the kinds of pathologies within higher ed and which tried to explain it in plain terms. Because the problem is there's lots of books like this, but they say things like, the problem with higher education is that it's full of left-wing social justice activists, or the problem with higher education is it's filled with a bunch of neoliberal ideologues. And neither one of those things is really quite right, but they don't have a lot of explanatory power either. We think it's just the people who work in higher ed are ordinary human beings. They're selfish, if not perfectly selfish. They are more likely to promote their self-interest than to promote others' interests. And the incentive structures inside of higher ed lead to situations where people can promote their interest at the expense of everybody else. And so we think you can explain the problems by simply looking at the incentive structures that are inside the academy. And when we went to do that, we found that it's not just small things on the side like the way that sports are funded, but it's deep problems with the great way that grades are done or which classes are required and which classes aren't.
Well, the conclusion you come to really, and you started out with this, is these people are just people who want jobs, want better jobs, and want more money for their job.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Chapter 2 of the book is looking at students, administrators, and faculty and saying, if you're a member of these groups, what are your basic incentives? What sorts of things are you trying to get? And when you look at what people benefit from, you realize they are often in situations where they can increase the cost that other people have to bear and promote their self-interest in doing so. So a nice, easy to sort of understand example of this would be, imagine you're an administrator working in a university. You probably genuinely care about the institutional mission, but you're also not a saint. So you get a situation where if you're trying to increase your own pay and increase your own status, the easiest way to do that is to increase the number of people who work underneath you and who work within your office. The more your office does, the more money you can kind of demand from the president or the provost or whoever you report to. And that's true even if adding these people doesn't really serve the bottom line that well, even if it turns out that they're kind of doing less for the university than it costs to hire them. So everybody has this incentive to engage in what's called mission creep, which is increasing the amount of stuff that your department does, and to increase the number of staff. And then you look at that and you realize this partly explains why, since 1970, the number of its students, full-time students, has gone up by about 50%. The number of full-time faculty has gone up by 50%. But the number of professional staff has gone up something like 250 to 300%.
There's examples that we look to in the book of why certain classes are required of students. So, you enter in as a freshman, but no matter what you choose as your major, you're always going to encounter a broad assortment of required courses that you have to get through. And normally you spend your first year and a half to 2 years knocking out what are called general education requirements, or gen eds. And one of the things we studied is how gen eds have evolved over time. So to give an example of people very rationally but also self-interestedly seeking out resources, we find that the majors that are declining in popularity that have trouble attracting students are also the majors that are more likely to insert themselves into the gen ed curriculum. In other words, they're getting funding for their department by requiring students to take more and more of their classes. Meanwhile, majors that are healthy, so we use economics as an example of something that regularly attracts lots of students, generally has a good job market post-graduation, it's far less common on the gen ed required curriculum than something like English, which has a declining number of majors. So what we see here is actually a mechanism where faculty that are having trouble attracting students to their classroom insert themselves into curricular decisions for the university at large. And over the course of many years of mission creep, so one of the statistics we use is from English, between the early 1970s and today, the number of required English courses that every student must take, no matter what they're majoring in, has essentially doubled. And you ask the question, who's paying for those courses? Well, it's the students, it's their parents, it's the loans that they're taking out to fund their education. So it's almost like a generational wealth transfer that's going on here from students who tend to be of a more precarious economic situation to mid-career faculty who are economically better off but are having trouble filling their classrooms.
In the book, you say you are not big fans of academic advertising. And I was trying to figure out after reading that whether I wanted a transformative experience or an unbridled experience. Which should I go for?
Yeah, Our joke in the book is that if a drug company were advertising the way that universities do, then it would be illegal. We have this joke. We say, imagine that Pfizer creates a new drug called Collegra, and they say, if you take Collegra, it takes 30 weeks per year over 4 years with approximately 30 hours per week during the weeks you're taking it, and it costs a couple $100,000 to take this drug. But if you take it, it will transform you into a morally superior person with massive critical thinking skills and the ability to analyze different sources of information and synthesize different ideas. And suppose they advertised this drug, but they'd done no testing to prove whether the drug delivered any of those benefits. Well, they'd be in trouble with the FDA, and they wouldn't be allowed to do it, and they'd have to pay massive amounts of fines. So it turns out, though, that universities are effectively doing just that. We went through and collected the kinds of promises universities put on their view books, on their brochures, the things that they tell parents and they send in letters, and they make these fantastic claims about how universities will transform your moral character, your intellectual character, and give you all of these skills that you'll be able to use in any aspect of life. But universities don't systematically test to see whether or not they actually deliver these goods. Even worse, though, there's a very large field of educational psychology that does rigorously test many of these claims and finds out that, in fact, for something like 9 out of 10 students, there will be no substantive change in any of these sorts of skills or mindsets or things students are supposed to get. So it's not quite what we call false advertising. You know, false advertising would be, I sell you my car and I tell you it goes 0 to 60 in 2 seconds, but I know I'm lying. It's more of what we might call negligent advertising. I believe it, but I'm not entitled to believe it. I remember in the 1980s when I was a kid, there'd be these commercials on for psychics that you could call, and like they would give you advice about your future. Some of those things, psychics were true believers, but they're still ripping you off, and they're still kind of morally reprehensible for advertising a service and a good they can't actually deliver, and they're not really excused simply by, you know, believing their own nonsense.
There are examples where we see, especially in elite institutions in the Ivy League, they actually improve their rankings as schools and as departments by the number of students that they reject. So they get a benefit in U.S. News and World Report and some of the other ranking systems through that exclusivity. Well, that creates a perverse incentive for these departments to actually seek out students that they never intend to really admit. And the university itself benefits from that because they can improve their ranking. So there's almost a deceptive angle that's going on in the way that some universities try to game these ranking systems.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, you know, given that this costs a lot of money, even just to apply to a university is taking you a few hours and probably about $50 or so, they're wasting precious time and money from students who can least afford to do it.
It's why you say it's one of the few products that actually brags about rejecting customers.
There's this perverse incentive that every university faces, including, by the way, not just to reject as many students as possible, but to try to figure out exactly which students will accept. If you offer admissions to students, you try to only offer admissions to students that you know will accept because your matriculation rate affects your ratings. So if I have two candidates and one's more qualified than the other, but the second one will actually accept the offer, that's the one that will admit. But they also have a strange incentive to overspend. So we did some calculations with like the U.S. News and World Report rankings, and we said we want you to imagine that somehow the University of Chicago, which was ranked number 3, I think, in 2017, the number 3 best university in the country, imagine they managed to provide as much research and as much education and exactly the same high quality, but somehow they were able to do it without spending a single penny. Well, in reality, that would make the university even better because you're delivering all these goods, but you're costing nothing. The net value you're adding to society would be much higher. But what would happen in the rankings is that they use spending as a proxy for quality. So in this hypothetical scenario where Chicago delivered exactly the same amount of stuff for nothing, they would drop from number 3 in the rankings to something like number 15. And so for that reason, universities have this perverse incentive to spend as much as possible because that affects your status. So if you're a new dean, you come in, your job as a dean or a president is to try to make the university look better, to move up in these zero-sum rankings. One easy way to do that is simply to spend a lot of money, even if it's not actually delivering anything of value to people.
Still to come, our conversation with Jason Brennan and Philip Magnus continues with a look at student evaluations of teachers and vice versa. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guests today are Dr. Jason Brennan, the Flanagan Family Professor at Georgetown University School of Business, and Dr. Philip Magnus, a Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. We're talking about their new book called Cracks in the Ivory Tower, The Moral Mess of Higher Education. In the book, they compare the method used for student evaluations of teachers to reading the entrails of lambs. Dr. Magnus explained.
Student evaluations are a very messy area of higher education. There's basically no consistency that goes on between classes. If you attend a class, you know these forms that they pass out at the end of the semester, asking students in the class to rate the professor, to rate how well the instruction was offered, supposedly providing a metric of quality in the class. But what you find is when you start to aggregate these metrics or compare them against each other, the standards behind them are not consistent from classroom to classroom or university to university. They're also very gameable metrics and display all sorts of biases that come into them. For example, there are several studies that show students tend to evaluate a professor higher if they get a better grade in the class. I mean, surprise, surprise. And then if they are facing a professor who grades harshly, that is often penalized in the form that they fill out at the end of the semester. We actually make the argument here that considering all these biases, all these skews that exist in student evaluations, to actually use them as a basis for promotion or the hiring of faculty is somewhat unethical. It's not only a poor metric, it's one that has demonstrated susceptibility to skews. So there's even some evidence that female professors or, in other cases, racial minorities are penalized at a greater degree on some of these evaluation metrics than say, like a white male professor. That would be discriminatory if you're using a metric like that that's skewed to make a hiring decision of someone in higher ed. And what we see is time and time again, if you actually subject these evaluations to deep scrutiny, there's no real scientific basis to argue in favor of them, but there's a lot of evidence that says that they lead to bad actors being promoted or they lead to situations where someone could be unethically penalized for something that's not really their fault.
It's important to recognize, too, that Phil isn't just saying the basics of them is decent, but it turns out they're so subjected to bias that they become invalid. It's rather, there's a large number of cases where educational psychologists are trying to study, do these things correspond at all with anything we could call learning outcomes? And to test this is pretty difficult, but nevertheless, people have done these sorts of studies, and they've measured how much did students actually learn in different kinds of classes. They get some sort of objective measurement of actual learning outcomes. And then when you do that, you compare them to student evaluations, you find not that there's no relationship, but there's something like a very slight negative relationship between getting good scores on your student evaluations and the amount that students learn. So they're an invalid mechanism for measuring teaching effectiveness. It would be like I was trying to measure your height by having you bench press and see how much you can bench press and like trying to guess what your height is based upon that. It's actually even that, that's, I'm being too nice to student evaluations because there's actually more of a correlation there than there is when it comes to student learning. But the use of student teaching evaluations does two things. One is it placates the students. It makes them think mistakenly that teaching effectiveness is being measured and that professors are being rewarded for being good teachers. They're not. That's not true because they don't work. The other thing it does, though, is it allows administrators to get increased power over the faculty, to manipulate them, to tell them how to teach, to fire them more easily, and so on. It makes sense. It's rational that these things are being used, but the purpose is not to make people better teachers. It's to help win the war between administrators and faculty on behalf of administrators.
Going the other direction, teacher evaluation grading students. You use the word for GPA oddball.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems with grading, too. And in a sense, the complaint we have is nothing new. We found a book published 100 years ago that says almost exactly the same thing we say. The problem is we've all kind of agreed to use the same symbols when it comes to evaluating students. We're going to say A, B, C, D, and F, or sometimes they say E at some universities. We're all using like the same things, but we mean different things by them. Getting an A in economics at, say, Econ 10 or something at Harvard University is not the same thing as getting an A in Econ 101 at Keene State College. But also, what these grades mean varies tremendously from class to class. So in some classes, Letter grades are a stand-in for what the professor thinks is good. They're qualitative descriptions. An A means excellent, a B means good, a C means satisfactory, a D means deficient or whatever. In other classes, a grade is a stand-in for, say, a percentage. So maybe you get a B in chemistry, and that means you got 85% of all the questions right that you took over a series of tests throughout the semester. And in other classes, so for example, if you take classes with me in the business school at Georgetown University, our letter grades are a crude approximation of your ranking because we have a curve and really all we're doing is ranking students. So getting an A with me means that you were ranked, say, 5 out of 45 or something like that. The problem then is between professors, these grades are not standardized. What they refer to isn't standardized. But also, it's literally incoherent to calculate GPA once you have different kind of metrics for grades. So just think of it this way. If an A in English means excellent and a B in chemistry means 85% and a B in, say, Finance 101 means ranked 17 out of 45, then what it is to calculate your grade for the semester is excellent plus 85% plus 17 out of 45 divided by 3 equals nothing. It doesn't mean anything. You can't actually do any sort of calculation there. So there's a kind of mathematical incoherence that exists when it comes to calculating GPA, and this might be rescued to some degree if it turned out that GPA corresponded to other sorts of things. And it is true that employers know that a person who gets a 4.0 GPA in physics is on average going to be smarter and more conscientious than the person who gets like a 3.5 GPA in, say, communications, which is a relatively easy major compared to physics. But it also turns out when we look at the research behind this that GPA does not really appear to be strongly predictive of future career performance or future success, and worse, that the use of grading actually impedes students' knowledge. So again, educational psychologists have tested this, and they wonder, when we offer feedback to students in the form of grades, how does it affect their learning? And the answer is it negatively affects it. It makes it so they learn less. They spend a lot more time worrying about getting the grade than they do about worrying about actually learning the material. So if we really wanted to serve students the best, given the current state of educational psychology, given what we know about how people learn, we would dispense entirely with letter grades. We wouldn't give them rankings or anything. And we would simply give them massive amounts of qualitative feedback explaining what they did well and what they could do better and offering them tips on doing that. But we end that chapter by saying, now, even though we think this is what the research says and this would be what's best for students, we, the people writing this book, have no incentive to lobby our own universities, our own employers, to implement these kinds of policies. Because, after all, I work at a research university, and my raise and my status is dependent almost entirely on the amount of and the quality of the research I produce, where I publish it, and who reads it. For me, the more time I spend grading, the more time I spend teaching, the less money I make. So that's kind of the perverse thing that goes on here. It's like even though we know this is, or we have very good evidence that this would be better for students than what we're currently doing, faculty have very little incentive to actually change to the other system. It costs them time and money. It benefits the students, but it doesn't benefit them.
Well, finally, the book starts out as not exactly a happy feel-good story. And at the end of the book, I'm still not feeling too good about things. Can you fix the cracks in the ivory tower or at least patch them up?
I think it's going to require a serious external shock because the problems that we see are based upon defects that come from working within a large nonprofit corporation and from how the fields work in general. It's all created by bad incentive structures where people can help themselves at the expense of everybody else, and there's little that the other people can do about it. For example, with the immoral or fake advertising that universities are doing, if someone were to sue them and win in court a tort case saying, like, you made these promises and you didn't deliver, so you ripped me off $200,000, I want my money back. Imagine, like, there was a class action lawsuit. If that happened and it succeeded, universities would very quickly, as soon as the lawsuit was settled, they would very quickly switch to better forms of advertising. Or if the government decided to regulate them and say, we're going to impose the same regulations on you as we do on automobile makers or drug manufacturers or other commercial enterprises, you're not allowed to advertise in ways that other businesses would be penalized for doing, that would fix it. There's also just the issue that these cost increases are not sustainable. If we're having a 6% increase in the total operating cost year after year after year, and this is over and above inflation, at some point the money is going to run out. I mean, education might be a superior good, a luxury good, but at some point the money is going to run out. and universities will be forced to have a reckoning, and they'll be forced to be maybe a bit more efficient. But as of now, the incentives inside the university are very poor. If I were personally to take over a university as a president, I would have an incentive to fix it. I'd have an incentive to do the same thing everyone else is doing. After all, how can I best get promoted and get more money for myself? Well, I can increase the operational budget, try to get as much money from government sources and from private donors as possible, and increase the number of things the university does, regardless of whether their value is high. And then when I do that, I'd be able to advertise myself as a person who creates growth, and then to be hired by an even better university at a higher salary. So I think it's going to take external shocks. I don't think it's going to be fixed from within.
Again, the name of Jason Brennan and Philip Magnus's new book is Cracks in the Ivory Tower, The Moral Mess of Higher Education. You can find it at Oxford University Press. So why is the line to the ladies' room usually longer than the one for the guys? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
One way to see gender discrimination in action is to look at the lines in public restrooms. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Catherine Anthony, professor in the School of Architecture at the University of Illinois, explores what can be done about it.
Have you ever had to wait in line to use a public restroom? What's the longest line you've ever waited in? Where was it? Who was with you? And how long was the wait? Chances are, if you're a female, it's happened to you a lot, less so if you're a male. Especially at stadiums, theaters, concert halls, and airports, anywhere crowds gather, men zip in and out in a flash, while women are forced to wait in line. Most public restrooms have fewer fixtures for women. This discrepancy is a subtle but powerful form of gender discrimination. Due to our physiological differences, females take longer than males. Women need to disrobe, store a purse, sit down, use toilet paper, and then put our clothes back on. Women who are menstruating, pregnant, or carrying babies or toddlers take even longer. Males have it much easier. Holding it in can lead to urinary tract infections and other health problems. In many of our nation's schools, and in parts of the world where restrooms are in deplorable condition or missing altogether, millions of women and girls are in danger. Until relatively recently, most architects, contractors, engineers, building code officials, and clients were not concerned about this issue. The movement to remedy this situation is known as potty parity. The goal is equal speed of access, usually more toilets for women. We've seen progress with updated building codes and potty parity laws requiring improved fixture ratios. Even better, unisex restrooms eliminate the gender discrepancy altogether. Yet these changes only affect new and newly remodeled buildings. Most of our existing building stock remains untouched, so we've still got a long ways to go. Think about it the next time you're stuck waiting in line at the restroom or waiting for the women in your life.
That was Catherine Anthony of the University of Illinois. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.